It isn't the government. There is no such thing as the government. There are several governments, and they're at war with each other. A real incredible breakthrough in what NASA and Viking claim they were searching for, life on Mars. Except, of course, they lied to us, they lied to us, they lied to us, and they've been lying on this subject for 30 years. So isn't the scientific method to check it out? No. Instead of checking it out, they ran at warp 9 in the other direction. Do you want people to realize there's a way to do things without drilling in the Middle East and all the political and economic infrastructure that's been built up? No, I don't think so. And that plan obviously has been in place for the last 40 years. Every person to be sovereign suddenly, where they would have unlimited amounts of energy from a thing running in their basement that they never have to look at and touch again for their lifetime, just by flipping a switch that would draw energy out of space, out of another dimension, that would be hyperdimensional. No, not if you're into control, because how do you control people? You keep them dependent on you for the critical resources of life. Then when NASA went out into space, it would logically find evidence of possibly more advanced beings. And it said in the charter, you know, on the moon, Mars, or Venus. Well, advanced beings would have to be created by somebody, right? The resolution of this paradox is that Ed Mitchell has had something happen to his mind.
Oh, that answer I did know. Okay.
The astronauts, okay, I believe, have been tampered with.
Yes.
There are all kinds of papers now coming out in the open literature about technologies which can selectively wipe out your memories on specific events. And I believe, and I have in the book, Mike and I carefully put in document after document after document of reference to all of the astronauts at one time or another have complained about not being able to remember what they did on the moon. The lie is different at every level.
I'm Carrie Cassidy. This is Project Camelot, and we are here with Richard Hoagland. And he's just written a book called Dark Mission with his partner, Mike Barra. And we are thrilled to be in his New Mexico home. So from here, basically, Richard, we're gonna run with you in the beginning and let you kind of lead us where you want to take us. And then at some point, I'm going to start steering you in different directions. And you can fight me, or you can agree with me.
Others have tried that.
You know, we can have a little jousting match, or however you want to deal with it, okay?
Okay.
But we'll have some fun, and hopefully we'll all learn something. What can you tell us about this new, amazing secret history of NASA?
Well, it's been a story that's many, many years in the making. I mean, at least 40-some years since the genesis of NASA itself back in 1958. What I'm intrigued with is how it's a story that I've tried to tell before in various venues. I've told it on, you know, the Art Bell Show, Coast to Coast. I've told it at the National Press Club in a press conference that we did with 8 other people, very prestigious background, NASA people, imaging people, in 1996. And it's a story that I've, you know, even told on television. But until we wrote Dark Mission, it hasn't seemed to take root. 2 weeks after the book was published, it became a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, that's what this nice little emblem up in the corner of the book says. That's not a mean feat to do when you've had no national television exposure on such a volume as this. The only exposure we've had, the only way that people found out that we had written a new book and we were looking at the background of NASA and what they've been telling us against the background of who they really are, was on the Coast to Coast audience and on the websites. We have two websites, enterprisemission.com, which is the formal website of the Enterprise Investigation, and we also have darkmission.net, which is the official website of the new book. I think it's kind of like the old Mark Twain quote, when it's steamboat time, you steam. I think we are politically in this country, actually in the world, particularly after the last 8 years, all of us are ready to get to the truth, to drop the lies. It is so overwhelming now. It is so in our face that people that we have trusted with our, our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor, that they've lied to us. And they've looked into the cameras and they have absolutely told us lie after lie after lie. So when Mike and I come out with a book that ostensibly is going to tell you the truth behind some of the lies about an agency that is not center in the mainstream except during launches from the Cape, I think that explains this grassroots groundswell where they literally, in the bookstores now, Barnes & Noble and the other chains, they can't keep it on the shelves. Mike's brother went into a Barnes & Noble up in Seattle the other day, and the clerk said, "Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Barra, but we had 20 in yesterday, and there's only one left." And, of course, that, to me, is really good political news because it means we're somehow connecting. We're connecting with the American people, and we get a chance to show them, to document the truth.
Mm-hmm. So what is the truth? What is the bottom line? And you can build the story however you want. But basically, you're saying that NASA has lied to us. In essence, our government has lied to us because they're one and the same, right? They're interwoven in some ways.
Not necessarily. See, okay. This is where people need to think nuance. People need to be much more sophisticated, which, of course, a 21st century viewer or reader these days is. It isn't the government. There is no such thing as the government. There are several governments, and they're at war with each other. And you see occasionally evidence in public that there is some kind of war, but in fact, most of the time, the nuanced positionings are hidden. It's really almost like the old feudal system. You know, we've all been raised on stories of Robin Hood and Sherwood Forest and the Sheriff of Nottingham and, you know, the King John and the terrible things that were going on in England when Sir Richard, you know, the good guy, the King of England, was off fighting in the Crusades and the bad guy, John, was basically trying to steal his empire behind his back while he was off doing good deeds. What we're looking at in the current U.S. government, which the Founding Fathers never in their wildest nightmare, except maybe for, you know, that vision that Washington ostensibly had at Valley Forge, they never imagined that there would be these baronies, these feudal kingdoms, these fiefdoms fighting with each other and with the American people over power. Ultimately, it's all about power.
So name the fiefdoms. Are you willing to do that?
Well, they're out on CNN. There's the Defense Department, and there's the State Department, and there's NASA, and there's the CIA, and all the alphabet agencies. You know, remember the National Intelligence Estimate that just told us a few days ago that, Iran really isn't developing a nuclear weapon and hasn't been for 4 years, was the compilation of 16 or 17 intelligence agencies that somehow all got together with a consensus and said, okay, We really were mistaken before. They aren't doing what the president has been telling you they're doing for months now, beating the drumbeats of war, threatening World War III. So people are seeing that there is this incredible internal food fight going on in the U.S. government, that there is no one government. There are, in the House and Senate alone, 535 governments, each member, each representative, each senator has their own perspective when they're actually answerable to their constituents.
Okay, are you going to talk about the below the level of the general consensus reality governments that are also going on?
Well, that's 5 light years away. Let's get there quietly, all right? Let's get there with some kind of transition, because for most people, the idea that what they see on CNN is not reality is a shock. Mm-hmm. We're just beginning in the mainstream, what I call the bell curve, because that's what it is. It's the middle of the road. It's the silent majority, as Nixon used to call it. We're just beginning to get those people to realize that their government, the people that they trust, the people that they elect, the people that they vote into power, may not be the people really running the show. That is a staggering leap for most people who really do think that when they show up at the ballot box, or they go to a caucus, or they participate in some kind of poll, that has real power. No, that has power in the public venue, but the real determiners of our fate are being determined in private and in secret, and we identify in dark mission, Notice how elegantly I brought it back.
That
to
was
my book.
A lovely segue.
We identify the three secret power groups who are in fact behind and in charge of and fighting with each other for power under the NASA emblem. And they are, because I can see that's where you want to go, they are the Nazis, the Masons,
and
the magicians.
Very good. Very good. So that's actually stunning that you would actually name them, at least at that level.
Why is it stunning? It's the truth.
Because very few people will.
That's what Dark Mission's all about, to tell people the truth. Because, you know, George had a guest on the other night, you know. He actually was a minister. He was a pastor who was taken by one of the top vice presidents of Atlantic Richfield up to Prudhoe Bay in the 70s when they were drilling on the North Slope and building the pipeline.
Right.
And he, you know, was very fond during his 4 hours on coast of quoting again and again from, you know, one of the biblical proverbs. You know, the truth shall set you free. Know the truth and the truth shall set you free. Well, the first step on the road to freedom is knowing you're being lied to. And one of the mantras that we have throughout Dark Mission is a line that was actually given to me by one of these intel agents. You know, you get calls from these people, you actually even have dinner with them, they come to conferences, you never really know how much of what they're telling you is the truth and how much is spin, how much is a veiled lie with a bit of truth embedded, otherwise no one will ever buy it. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly making decisions when you rely on sources, which we at Enterprise really try not to do, and I'll expand on that in a minute. This individual gave me a stunningly interesting line. In fact, it probably was the second most important thing that anybody in public life has ever told me. The first was my old friend Gene Roddenberry, which I'll get back to in a second. This intel agent said to me in one of our early conversations, reiterated over and over again, it's become kind of like an in-joke, you know, when we're on the phone talking to each other. The lie is different at every level. Meaning that even the people who are in front of the camera spinning, telling you that the world is coming to an end, telling you that the dollar is crashing, telling you that we're running out of oil, telling you that we have to nuke Iran before they nuke us, telling you that, you know, Sodom had weapons of mass destruction, most of those people really believe what they're telling you. Mm-hmm. Because they've been told lies by people that they trust.
Right.
So the lie goes up the line. Every little group is controlled and contained and constrained by being fed exactly how much BS they will believe. So they can come out in front of the cameras at like the National Press Club or at the White House when the president's spokesperson comes out. She believes 99% of the stuff she's saying. She's not in on the lie. She doesn't know it's a lie, because if she did, she couldn't be the actress that she is.
Exactly.
The lie has to be different at every level in order for the entire assemblage of lies to ultimately control all the rest of us and to contain the truth. And by contain, I don't mean, you know, encapsulate. I mean suppress it.
Okay.
Keep it away.
Tell me something. When did you get clued in? All those years back when you were working for Walter Cronkite.
Yes.
Were you clued in then?
Oh, that I wish I had been. No, I was young, I was naive, I was idealistic, I was so enthralled with the idea that they would tap a 23-year-old on the shoulder and actually listen to my advice. But I was paying attention. I just didn't have the big picture. And I'll give you an example. We had a meeting one evening in the executive producer's office. And it was on a weekend, and there was supposed to be this press conference by astronauts. I think it was during Apollo 8. You know, what you do is you launch from the Cape, you'd spend 3 days going to the moon, you do your thing at the moon, go into orbit, land, whatever, then you would take 3 days coming home. Normally, under these missions, the only people that ever got to talk to the astronauts was what was called a CAPCOM, a capsule communicator, basically another astronaut. And NASA set this policy up in the very beginning because you don't want confusion under critical moments of too many voices. So even all the other flight controllers, all the other people at NASA that are running the mission, all funnel their information through one guy who then talks to the crew. The first deviation from that really important and obviously responsible position was this Sunday afternoon when the astronauts were falling home to Earth, you know, nothing to do for 2-3 days between Earth and Moon. I mean, just imagine that scene. You're floating in zero G. There's this incredible views out the window, the Earth out one window, the Moon receding out the other. And you're basically bored. So what they did is they set up the first press conference in space where members of the press assembled in Houston got a chance to go on mic and actually directly ask the astronaut questions. They had three astronauts on the Apollo program. This was unheard of. This was amazing. This was wonderful. This was transparency. So we're looking at our clocks and watches, and we're looking at the monitors, and we've got the links, you know, satellite links to Houston, and we're waiting, in essence, for the spacecraft to rise above the horizon at Goldstone, California, where there's a huge, big dish, 64-foot satellite antenna, basically, that is looking at the spacecraft between Earth and Moon and is going to take the signal and receive and send the actual questions. And, of course, and for that to happen, it has to be able to see the spacecraft. Well, because it's on a rotating Earth and the geometry of the Moon and where the spacecraft is and all that could not be changed, they had to wait for the spacecraft to rise over the horizon in the desert of Goldstone before the press conference could begin. So we're sitting there and we're, you know, talking to each other, and, you know, the executive producer guy's feet up on his desk, and there's a bunch of other people sitting on his couches in the
office. And are you at JPL?
No, we're in New York at the CBS News Broadcast Center on West 57th Street.
Oh.
Hooked in electronically.
Okay.
You know, even then, those dark ages, we had television by satellite, you know, and we were able to see what was going on. We're watching the monitors, we're watching Houston, we're watching the press corps, and we're waiting for the astronauts to appear electronically. They also had a TV camera in the spacecraft. We're all waiting for them and Houston to be able to connect with them via the Goldstone ground station. And the PIO, public information officer, comes on from NASA and says, well, we're waiting for the spacecraft to rise above the horizon, the mountains at Goldstone. So, you know, I'm 23, right? And I'm thinking, that's weird. This doesn't make any sense. So I took out, you know, your typical cliched envelope, and I started scribbling some equations. And, you know, you basically take the radius of the Earth and the way it rotates and the height of the mountains, you know. And I leaned over to my executive producer and I said, psst, Bob, NASA's lying. You know, what? I said, they're lying to us.
Oh, my God.
Now, this was something so incredibly trivial. Like who cared? But I said, if he's telling the truth, the mountains that they're waiting for the spacecraft to rise over have to be 5,000 miles high. They had to be lying. So it turned out later that what they were really doing is waiting for Jules Bergman, who had gotten drunk the previous night, who was a senior correspondent for space for ABC News.
Oh,
he had
no.
gotten drunk, he got up late, he didn't make it to the press room in time, and NASA was covering with a technical piece of BS so Jules Bergman, who was their pet correspondent, could get on camera and ask the first question in this historic correspondent asked astronaut in space live without a flight controller or a Capcom in between. That was my first example on the record of when I looked at NASA and realized they were lying, and it was so silly. That, with that as background, as I got into this whole area of looking at Mars, looking at the Moon, looking at the politics, looking at the secret societies, the agendas and all that, that first example
wow.
where I was not believed, because who was I? I was just a consultant to CBS News. NASA could do no wrong. I mean, Wessler basically said to me, you got to be nuts. There's no way. He accepted, we all did in those days, NASA's word over anybody else having to do with the space program. Well, what Dark Mission is an expose that NASA can't be trusted, because starting with those 5,000-mile-high mythical mountains, they have not been for 40 years telling us the truth.
Fast forward, here we are. You've written this incredible book. And tell us that little story that you were telling us before about, you know, the moment on television, et cetera. I mean, because it's not real until it's TV.
Well, when I got into this, when I started looking at data, as opposed to, you know, the mountain thing was just stupidity. But when I started looking at data was on the occasion of the JPL unmanned Viking probes in 1976, where I was again a representative of CBS News at JPL for that incredible, unbelievable Viking summer. That's what we called it, the Viking summer. When this nation on the bicentennial year sent two unmanned spacecraft to land on Mars for the first time, and two more to orbit, you know, taking hundreds of thousands of pictures, and it launched the official investigation of the possibility of life on Mars. Well, somewhat after this process began, somewhere around the 25th, I think, of July, one of the key guys in the Viking mission, his name was Dr. Jerry Soffin, stood up in front of us in the JPL, now we're now in California, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, which I think you have more than a passing knowledge of. And Soffin stood up and he, on the screen, projected kind of like this, a picture showing the face on Mars. That quirky thing with the little black specks on it, you know, with a kind of a snarled lip that has been in every book everywhere on the planet over the last 30 or so years. And he pointed to it and he said, you know, isn't it funny what tricks of light and shadow can do? Big laugh from all us assembled press people. When we took a picture a few hours later, it all went away. It was just a trick of light and shadow. So I'm there. I'm another witness to this statement, to this process. Fast forward the film. I get into the process of actually looking at this picture decades later in the 1980s, in the late 80s, around 89. And I find that everything that Soffin told us also was a lie. It wasn't a trick of light and shadow. When you do the actual computer processing, it's a stunningly symmetrical statue, a mile and a half long and half a mile high. And we've had umpteen images now. We've had other independent, you know, computerized enhancements of the various data. There's 3D modeling. There's stereo. There's shape from shading. There's all kinds of analysis. All of it, by the way, performed by us outside NASA. NASA has ignored and simply told everybody it's just nonsense. Go away, go away. Gosh, NASA says that. Amazing. But the key moment was when I discovered, when I went back through the timeline, is that Jerry's statement, and I can call him Jerry because I knew him pretty well, was also a lie. There was no picture taken of the face on Mars a few hours later. Technically, a few hours later, as Mars rotated and the orbit of the Viking camera changed, that region of Mars was in darkness. They couldn't take a picture. The next opportunity to take a picture was 1 month later, actually 35 days. And the picture was taken, which is unusual because at that time in the mission, they hardly ever took two pictures of the same piece of real estate. And they had to wait a month to come back in the geometry and take the second picture, which, of course, if you look at it from the outside, somebody was checking that if it was the same thing there on the second frame at a different sun angle, science says it's probably real. It probably was a real face. It was a real statue. It was a real enigma, a real incredible breakthrough in what NASA and Viking claimed they were searching for, life on Mars. Except, of course, they lied to us. They lied to us. They lied to us. And they've been lying on this subject for 30 years. That's what got me into asking, is it really that they're lying or are they just fools? Are they scientists who have no conception of how real science should operate, which is that when you see something so stunningly in the middle of your paradigm, you have a mission, you have a whole taxpayer-funded mission, billions of dollars spent looking for life on Mars. Well, a mile-wide statue kind of is life. It's built by somebody, maybe. So isn't the scientific method to check it out? No. Instead of checking it out, they ran at warp 9 in the other direction.
Okay, but if they were lying back then, and that was one of the first missions to Mars.
It was the first landing and orbital mission.
Then they must have been prepared to lie. I mean, isn't that the supposition? They knew what they were going to find? Is this where the secret space program was already in operation prior to this mission?
Okay, this now gets a little technical. Viking was not the first mission to Mars. The first was Mariner 4 in 1965. The second was Mariner 6 and 7 that occurred during the Apollo summer when I was covering the first manned landings on the moon with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. And we went from North American Rockwell, where we had built a whole studio complex, including a walk-through solar system, which was my idea. And we went up the street, up the hill to JPL to finish covering the Apollo return, because they were about halfway between Earth and Moon. And we had to also cover the Mariner 6 flyby and 7 flyby of Mars, the second unmanned missions. And then the third unmanned mission that was sent to Mars by this country, by the United States, was in 1971. It was called Mariner 9. But as opposed to being a flyby, where you basically take a few shots as you go away forever, it was the first U.S. spacecraft to go into orbit around Mars. And it radically transformed all our thinking. So as I reconstruct history, I'm looking at the Viking images of Cydonia, of the face on Mars, and I'm saying that there have to exist somewhere. We have not found them. They're not in any public file. There have to exist secret images taken by Mariner 9 in 1971. Because Viking was 76, you've got 72, 73, 74, 75, 5 years to have predetermined there was something really interesting down there on the plains of Cydonia.
Okay.
So when we put Viking into orbit, they knew exactly where to take the new, much better pictures.
Was it discussed as a possibility that the Viking lander would actually land in Cydonia, but then it was dismissed as being too rocky? Have I remembered?
Yes, you are remembering that exactly correct. The first landing site was in something called the Plains of Gold, Chrysi Planitia in Latin. And the second landing site, they were talking about landing in Cydonia. Now, before everybody gets their hearts aflutter, you got to keep in mind, this is like talking about landing in North America or landing in Albuquerque in my backyard. Cydonia is a big place, Mr. Scott, quoting from Star Trek. So even if they had planned to land in Cydonia, the odds are we would have been nowhere near the interesting stuff where the face and the city and all that complex is located. No, what's interesting to me politically is that after the initial announcement that they were going to land in Cydonia, after the first pictures were taken by the Viking 1 orbiter, the trajectory of the second spacecraft coming along behind, not even put into orbit around Mars yet, was changed so they would land in a completely different place. So it's like whoever was doing the programming didn't want even the possibility that they might land by accident in Cydonia and see this stuff up close.
Okay, so I'm assuming that you're talking about ruins that they knew about, they had prior knowledge. And you're saying they had prior knowledge because they had another space program.
That's one level of the prior knowledge.
Right.
That we can prove.
Okay.
Unquestionably we can prove, except we haven't found the missing Mariner 9 images. We found Mariner 9 images of other interesting things that were discussed. Sagan and Cosmos talked about the pyramids of Elysium. They're these huge, several mile wide tetrahedral pyramids located halfway around the planet from Cydonia. And in one of Carl Sagan's books, he actually relates them in an interesting metaphorical passage to each other. And I don't remember the details, but I thought it was strikingly intriguing, both at the time and in hindsight, that Carl would connect those dots. But that's the only pretty hard data we have. We know we had a spacecraft on station, Mariner 9. We know we had another spacecraft come along 5 years later, Viking. It's logical to assume if we had really good shots, perfectly framed, of the face on Mars and the pyramids from Viking, that they could have had prior knowledge from the lower resolution images from Mariner 9. That's not a stretch. That's not a leap at all. What I think gets really interesting is when you begin to ask the question, is it possible they knew there was something there to photograph at all from a long, long time ago in a history far, far away? And that gets back to the three groups running NASA inside: the Nazis, the Masons, and the Magicians.
Okay.
Because two of those groups, the Nazis and the Masons, we know had textual evidence, ancient documents, stuff, text, books, records left over from a long time ago. That's kind of like their shooting script. They've been using it to basically go around the solar system and take pictures of stuff that they have intimations exist out there but don't have scientific proof.